We are privileged to begin with an hour-long session with Professor John Hick, in whose honor this symposium is being held. We're very grateful that he is here. He is, of course, he's been here yesterday, taking an active part in the symposium, listening to the papers, putting up with them patiently in many cases, and also responding to certain questions when they come up. And today, the whole hour will be devoted to him and his work. The format will be as follows. I've been asked to read a statement about John's activity against racism and so on, which has been made by Canon David Jennings, who is rector of Burbage, the canon theologian at Leicester Cathedral. And John has asked that the first few minutes be spent on this dimension. After that, John will make a statement, and then there will be questions and answers. This is written by Canon David Jennings. I was director of All Faiths for One Race, AFOR, in the late 1970s, working with John, who was chairman at the time. We were also both actively involved in the formation and running of the organization, Christians Against Racism and Fascism. Whilst at AFOR, we published John's incisive and critical pamphlet, The New Nazism of the National Front and the National Party, 1977, and his booklet, Christianity and Race in Britain Today, 1978. John has kindly given me permission to update the latter. It is his political, social, and anti-racist theology that I most remember, and which unfortunately has not received the prominence it should in the symposium. Often on a Wednesday afternoon, John and myself would deliver furniture in Handsworth to single West Indian parents in his camper van. This was theology in action. I remember also a serious disagreement between John and my old friend, Father Ken Leach, who suggested, in the light of the experience of the confessing church in Germany in the 1930s, that those who held a low Christology were prone to support fascism. Clearly, John's Christology could not lead in this direction, but Ken held strong views about the state of the German churches in Nazi Germany. The work at AFOR, All Faiths for One Race, was pioneering at the time when much of what was done and advocated has now become mainstream. However, the threat of creeping fascism is still very much a reality, with the electoral success of the British National Party, including potential increased support if it were not identified with fascism, and the activities of the English Defence League. I would respectfully suggest that contemporary theologians should take example from John in this area and apply their theology and philosophy to this critical issue, which may take precedence over some of the more sterile debates concerning, for example, whether one religious faith is more salvific than another, or whether John is a theologian or a philosopher of religion, or even the trichotomy of exclusivism, inclusivism, or pluralism. I'm only reading this quote. And I do not necessarily believe what is I'm reading. As important as all these issues are, for many they are somewhat old hat and the world has moved on. Unquote. Well, I think after having done my duty and read this, I think the heart of it is very important. The heart of it is that John has played a dynamic and important role in the struggle, in the fight against fascism, against many of these forces that are creating a certain resurgence in some parts of this country now in terms of the electoral and other process, especially in the context of the opening up of Europe to people from Eastern Europe and other places who can come and work across the European continent and in this country. So the first few minutes, at John's request, will be devoted to considering this question. And if any of you, I think John now would like to make a statement, and then we can start the process. Over to you, John.
Thank you, Julius. Yes, I'm actually rather grateful to David Jennings, although he's not here, for that, or most of it. I agree with Julius about the some of it. It might be of interest to you to hear how we got on with the churches in Birmingham at this time. By we, I mean people at AFOR, for whom I wrote this pamphlet on the new Nazism of the National Front and National Party, getting all my information, incidentally, not from myself, but from a very brave man who was the founder and first editor of the journal Searchlight, which still exists today and monitors the activities of the extreme right-wing groups. And he was a very brave man. He was actually knifed, seriously, not fatally, but knifed at a demonstration in London because he was known to be the editor of Searchlight. But coming back to this pamphlet, we wanted, if possible, to get a preface signed by the Anglican Bishop of Birmingham and the Roman Catholic Archbishop of Birmingham and the moderator of the Free Church Council, because we thought this would commend it to the churches. And rather to our surprise, they said no. And the reason why they said no was that, at least the reason they gave, was that in this pamphlet I listed a long list of criminal offences by the leaders of these two movements. They'd all of them been in prison for things like illegally professing, having firearms, beating people up, etc., etc. So I listed all these convictions, and as an academic I double-checked the fact by looking back through the Times reports in the Birmingham Library. It was all absolutely correct. But the legal advisor to the Bishop of Birmingham, this is a good few bishops ago, by the way, things are very different today, the legal advisor, citing the Rehabilitation of Offenders Act, said that it would be illegal to refer to these convictions. Well, it so happened that Claire Short, who was also a director at a different time of AFOR, long before she became a Member of Parliament and Member of the Cabinet and so on, a friend of hers was a junior minister in the then government, Labour government, who had steered this act through Parliament, and he was himself a lawyer. So obviously he was an authority on it, and he gave us his official legal opinion, as it's called in the capital O, that it was perfectly legal to cite these convictions, but it would be open to the National Front or the National Party to sue us for defamation, but if they did, we would undoubtedly win. So we rather hoped that they would. But unfortunately, they must have got the same legal opinion, and they didn't. So anyway, so the thing was published without any preface by the official church leaders of Birmingham, but with a very good preface by a very famous Methodist minister in his own personal capacity, although he was actually president of the Methodist Conference for that year. And I think it cost sixpence. It sold extremely widely. I mean, we had to keep reprinting it. So that was just a little incident that may be of interest to you. But I do want to stress that this was in the 70s. We're now many years later. And I doubt if any subsequent Bishop of Birmingham would have acted in the same way. Archbishops, I'm not quite so sure about. You see, their real problem, was that amongst their flock, I don't mean amongst their clergy mainly, but amongst their lay flock, there were many racists. just as many probably as in the general public, proportionately. And they didn't want to offend them by supporting this document. So that was the real issue. Anyway, so that was that. So I think enough of that. So now then, I think it's a very good idea to allow time for students to have the first go, as it were, in questions, because otherwise they may tend to sort of leave it to people in the more in the front here, more senior people. So I'd like to invite any students who are here to ask any questions they like, and I'll try to answer them.
Hi, I'm a student. I'm a part-time PhD student here at the University of Birmingham. I'm getting a PhD in Quaker Studies, and actually doing work on a Quaker theology of reconciliation.
Thank you.
And last year I was in Belfast getting MPhil for Trinity College. There's a program in reconciliation studies, actually, in Belfast, studying all aspects of reconciliation, whether it's between reconciliation theology or reconciliation praxis, specifically between an ethnic conflict, but sort of studying all areas of reconciliation and conflicts that have occurred around the world. One aspect of reconciliation theology that I found really interesting is the idea that there's an interconnected web between all people, and not just sort of an idea that we're all human, so ergo we are connected, but there actually literally is sort of an interconnection. I sort of view it as the Spirit, specifically as the Holy Spirit, but it seems that in looking at other areas, there are in other traditions, there's been similar talk. And I guess with that sort of broad spectrum preface, I wanted to know what your view of that concept is, and specifically in terms of its practical applicability for reconciliation, for potentially, specifically in my tradition, sort of converting Christian theology into viewing ourselves as much more interconnected.
Yes.
But maybe, I guess, in terms of the view of the conference, more towards an interreligious dialogue question.
Thank you very much. Now, I'm not quite sure whether what I'm going to say first is strictly in answer to your question, only you will know. But I do think that that it's extremely probable that we are all interconnected at an unconscious level through what is called ESP, extrasensory perception, to which I think there's overwhelming evidence that there is such a thing. It's also called telepathy sometimes. But I think that at an unconscious level, we are all interconnected, and we are all affecting one another all the time by our thoughts, but even more by our emotions. And we are affecting others, and others are affecting us. But of course, there is a very strong screening process which preserves our personal identity. Now, that's not quite what you were talking about, I think, or is it?
It's similar to that. I was intrigued by the ontological connection between humans. If we understand the Spirit to be something that sort of occupies all of creation, so really does breathe over all of creation, interpenetrates all of us. But then I started looking around in science, and I realized that not only is there ESP, but there is sort of even just in terms of how we share our own, share electrons, share the air we breathe. But in terms of a theological or philosophical construct, I found that the ontological is potentially a little too dry and useless in my own ministry contexts. And Yes, I guess that's my question, is, you know, taking that ontological, which may actually exist, and bringing it into a more practical space, how that could actually be brought about, you know, how a loyalist in East Belfast could somehow truly view themselves as actually connected in a deep way to a Republican in West Belfast.
Yes. Thanks very much. I think we need to ask if there's anyone else. Thank you. Who has a question? Another student, please come forward. Yes, and then you. Yes.
First you. Yes. She says she's right in front. We need that microphone.
Sorry. Yeah. Okay.
Let's wait for the microphone.
Can you give her the mic? And if you keep your question succinct, so that more can take part. Yes, please.
I will do it succinct anyway. I just wanted to ask where, like, we as students are the people who are going to be taking things forwards in the future.
Mm-hmm.
Where would you like to see us putting our efforts in kind of research or careers afterwards?
Yeah, good question. No, I think things have to happen at two levels. At the practical level, which I think is actually the most productive one, what we want is to try to get people of different faiths working together on common local problems. I mean, for example, in Birmingham, we have the Christian churches, very many of which are very happy indeed to cooperate with people of other faiths. And we have the very large Muslim community, and there are quite a few mosques and churches in close proximity to one another where there are very friendly relationships between them. And there's quite a large Sikh community. In fact, I would think that the huge Sikh Gurudwara on Soho Road in Handsworth is possibly the biggest and most splendid religious building in Birmingham. And they also do a great deal of social work and also collaborate with people of other faiths. So at the practical level, this is to be encouraged in every possible way, much more than it is at the moment. I mean, there are people working full-time on it. We need even more. Now, on the theoretical or academic level, we have all the sorts of problems that were brought up yesterday, and more will no doubt be brought up today. And these need to be worked through further. And so this is always more work to do. And it's done in books and in articles and in conferences. And I hope there will be more and more of both.
Thanks very much. You had a question, and then you, and then perhaps you can move on to a broader. Yes.
I'm sorry, I didn't read much of your book, but I'm very interested in your work.
Could you speak up a bit, please?
Okay. I haven't read much of your book. I just always come across your name, but and I heard about, and you didn't mention that you had a personal religious experience in your meditation, and that makes me feel very curious.
Makes you feel
curious.
Oh yes. Not furious.
How much that kind of personal, spiritual, or religious experience impact your philosophical speculation? I'm asking these questions because I'm working on the comparative research between Zhu Xi, the Chinese philosopher, and Meyers Eckhart. So I saw in both of them the very strong, the two extremes. On one side, they are very scholastic, and on the other side, they're very mystic. So that's why I'm very interested in you, how you combine these two elements.
The two elements being the mystical.
Mystical and the scholastic.
Yes.
The intellectual element.
Yeah. Well, you know, many of the great theologians sticking to Christianity now of the past have also been mystics. I mean, the great Thomas Aquinas, with his massive, you know, works at the end of his life, said this is all straw. It's not the reality of religion. The reality of religion is in religious experience, not in the organizations, not in the systems of belief, but in religious experience. And fortunately, within the organizations of each faith, there is space for the mystical element. I mean, within Islam, Sufism is extremely powerful, not in every Muslim country, but in many of them. It's extremely powerful. And this is a wonderful movement. I very much like a saying of one of the great Sufi mystics, Rumi, Jalal ul-Din Rumi, in which he said, the lamps are different and many, but the light is the same. That's a wonderful brief statement of religious pluralism. The lamps are different, but the light is the same. The light being the presence of the ultimate reality, whatever we call it. And the lamps, of course, being the different organizations. I don't know whether this answers your question or not.
Well, yes. So on that respect, do you suggest us, the students, to learn meditation in the meantime? Will we be
sorry, can you speak up a bit?
On that respect, do you suggest that the young student like us to learn kind of meditation?
Yes, I would recommend everybody to practice some form of meditation. There are various forms that are all equally effective. I do indeed recommend that. There's another.
We have one last question here. You put your student?
No.
We want a student. The last question for a student, then. We open it to a broader discussion since we're nearly halfway through the session, and of course students can continue to ask questions, but as part of the broader discussion. So would a student now ask this of this phase the last question, please? Yes.
I'm a PhD student of Department of Theology and Religions. I have one question based on my readings. The question is about the real and the relation between the real and the ambiguous universe. My question is, it seems that Professor didn't clarify the relations between the real and the ambiguous, the ambiguous universe.
Yeah.
My question is, if the real and the universe, the universe are two, and it seems that there are a gap, or a gap between the physical, our physical, and the religious experience.
Now, have I got this right? You're asking what is the relationship between, let us call it the ultimate, rather than use my own pet phrase, between the ultimate and what I call the religious ambiguity of the universe. Well, the religious ambiguity of the universe, by which I mean the fact that it is possible to interpret it both in a purely naturalistic way, which includes an interpretation of religion, or in a religious way, which includes an interpretation of the naturalistic point of view, these are both equally possible, so that in itself it is ambiguous. And this makes it possible for there to be a reality that is not given directly to us, but which we can make ourselves accessible to. This is what the religions are supposed to be for. So the religious ambiguity of the universe sets us at a what I call an epistemic distance from this ultimate reality. If we were not at this epistemic distance from it, obviously not a distance in space, if we were sort of bang up against it, we would be simply overwhelmed. We're not ready for that. We're not ready, in Christian terms, for the vision of God. So I think both ideas are important.
Thank you very much. Now, we go on to the larger discussion, because half the session is over, and students, by all means, are very welcome to take part in this. If you put your hand up, I will ask you to speak. But I'm opening this up now to the broader discussion. So, including, not least, and I quote, old hat topics, such as whether John is a theologian or a philosopher of religion, or even a trichotomy of exclusivism, inclusivism, or pluralism, because these theoretical issues are very important. We all realize that. Now, anyone would like to start discussion? We have one here, and then Professor King, and then Paul Nitter. Yes, please. Succinctly, please, so that you can get as many in as possible.
Great honour to be here. I'm asking this question on behalf of someone who can't be here, your late friend, my late father, Hassan Askari. Would you agree that we've now reached a point regarding the expression pluralism, that pluralism is not the end, as was stated yesterday, that maybe we can say with confidence that all people of faith should say that perhaps we need more than one religion, and to mean it, to express that the divine cannot be limited to the form and faith of one practice. Can we say that now?
Well, I'm inclined to think that the value of there being different religions and different types within each religion is that different people need a different kind of spiritual discipline, let's call it, or a different kind of ladder by which to rise. For some, social action is the expression of their faith. For some, mystical experience. For some, ritual. Ritual can be a very powerful mediator of the presence of the divine or the ultimate. So all of these things are required, and the mystical is emphasized in Buddhism and in various some forms of Hinduism. There are many, many forms, as you know. The ritual is emphasized in the Roman Catholic tradition and the High Anglican tradition, and so on. And I think it would be, if there were one single world religion which operated everywhere in the same way, I think that would be a great loss, not a gain.
Thank you. Professor King?
Professor Hitt, I've just so much appreciated how beautifully and sensitively you have explained the mystical and practical and theoretical aspects of religion. We've just talked about this now. I've been curious why you have not discussed in any of your books more about spirituality, because what you've just said now, to me, raises really this contemporary discussion about religion versus spirituality, or how does spirituality relate to religion. And I would appreciate your comment on that.
Yes, thank you. I have in fact written about spirituality. I'm trying to remember which book. I'm afraid there are so many of them.
But, if I may say, I've checked your indices to my 10 books. I've not found a single reference to spirituality. But you speak at the end of the interpretation of religion. You have a quotation on spirituality, which I've used. But it is possible, this may not be your fault, it's possible that the index is not very well done. It doesn't cover all the entries. different entries, because cosmic optimism, on which you finish, is also not indexed. So
but
there
I
are important parts which are not indexed.
Yes, thank you. Well, I seem to remember that there is a chapter at the end of one of the books, but I can't now remember which, called Spirituality for Today. But I mean, nevertheless, that doesn't affect the point you make. I mean, spirituality is actually a rather difficult word to define, isn't it?
Yes.
How would you define it?
The values, attitudes, and practices that nourish people's life, and that may be in relation to the divine, in relation to others, in relation to themselves. So it's about the personal, the social, the planetary, globally.
Sure. Yes, well, I mean, that's extremely broad, and I'm all for it.
Paul, Anita, yes, please.
John, one of the recurrent criticisms or accusations that come up again and again in those who have criticized you is that you, operating out of your, as they say, your Kanchen model, that you have really established not just an epistemic difference between the noumenal and the phenomenal, but an epistemic divide.
Mm-hmm.
That there is really no connection between the noumenal and the phenomenal in your understanding. That's their accusation. In other words, that all of our conceptions of the divine are, in a sense, coming from ourselves, but have really no contact with, or there's no influence of, the ultimate or the noumenal.
Yeah.
And so they do claim an epistemic divide. I have tried to defend you. Can you help me?
Thank you very much, Paul. Well, I think that in his part of his paper yesterday, Eugen put the connection very clearly indeed when he said that when we look at something, we all see it from a different angle. So what we actually see, what is on the retina of our eyes, is different. And the distance, the further something is away, the smaller it looks, and so on. And yet it's the same thing. So, this is just an analogy. If the thing, the table, is the thing in itself, none of us actually see the thing in itself as it is in itself. We all see it in a different way, every single one of us, because we're all slightly... in a slightly different position in space. The connection is extremely close. I mean, the phenomenal is the noumenal as humanly experienced. People, of course, object very much. Some people do, that is, to using Kant, because Kant is not the... the flavour of the year amongst many philosophers. though personally, I think he is the greatest philosopher of the modern world. But although I do use Kant, I don't have to refer to Kant at all, because if we go back to Thomas Aquinas many centuries earlier, he said, let's see if I can actually remember the quotation, cognita sunt in cognoscenti. Carry on.
In
English, things known are in the knower according to the mode of the knower.
Secundum modum conoscendi.
Yes, I think that's a brilliant statement. Things known are in the knower according to the mode of the knower. Now, of course, in religion, the mode of the knower varies within the different traditions, so that the thing known, the ultimate, is not known directly. It is known according to the mode of the knower, that is, all the ideas and and also practices of people within the different religious traditions.
John, if I can just come in here, I seem to remember, this is an important piece of literalism in response to what Paul said, that there is a phrase in your writing where you speak of prevenient pressure from the point of view of the real. And I think that's stuck in my head. There's a prevenient pressure, so that either in the Copernican Revolution one or in the first edition of the Magnum Opus, and that prevenient pressure sort of bridges that gulf.
And that
expression is stuck in my head, so that it's not purely a passive receptivity or what. There is a two-way process. He said it somewhere, and it stuck in my head. So if he doesn't officially repudiate it now, we then have something to go on there.
Yes.
But
is that phrase prevenient pressure one I've actually used myself?
Yes, and that's why it's stuck in my head. I promise I did not invent it. It's there for those who borrow into your
right.
Your
do you happen to remember whether it came in an early or a late book?
Early-ish.
Well,
I think you've never actually repudiated it. So
no. Well, of course, a lot depends. Everything depends, of course, on what exactly it means. But I certainly do not think that the ultimate is a personal being who is actively revealing himself or herself to us. That would be one prevenient pressure, I think, I suppose, that I don't believe in. Rather, the ultimate is always there, always, in fact, everywhere. And it's when we're open to it that we become aware of it. So it's not exactly a pressure. It's an impact. That is a word that I've definitely used. It is the impact of the real, the ultimate upon us, insofar as we are conscious of it, but always conscious, of course, in a particular form.
Yes, well, the alliteration stuck in my head, the PP, and it wasn't in a personalist context. It was not, like you said, there was a personal prevenient pressure.
No.
But I think it will repay further study in that sense. But we move on. I think it's Professor Marilyn McCourt Adams and then Professor Schmidt-Leuker. Yeah, okay. Yes, Marilyn.
I want to come back to the question that this chap raised about the religious ambiguity, and what struck me that you said in reply that the real, of course, is always there, but we're not ready to experience it. We're not ready for that. And I've always been puzzled about what readiness consists in. In Evil and the God of Love, you made it sound as if it's not that our cognitive arrangements are not ready for it, but if God were to expose God's self too much, then we wouldn't make a free response. But in the later books, it seemed to me that it would be more natural to say, but you don't exactly say, that given what we are, given the kinds of things that we are, there's a process that's necessary to rearrange us so that we will be able to perceive or to unite with the real in some way, and so that it's more a question of our nature and what we are rather than a kind of latent free will defense type thing.
Yes.
that might be at work, and I just wonder what your present view is. Mm.
Well, I want to say both of those things, both that I mean, if putting it in Christian terms, If the situation was such that we could not help being aware of God, of being in the presence of God all the time, God knowing us through and through, knowing our most intimate thoughts and feelings and so on, this would be, it would undermine our freedom in relation to God, freedom to respond freely to God. So that's one thing that I want to affirm. And I've forgotten what the other
Well, the point would be that it's not a question of our self-determination, but a question of our inward rearrangement, make us naturally able to perceive.
Yes.
In other words, that somehow the rearrangement, the move from self-centeredness to reality-centeredness makes us perceptually apt, able to perceive.
I don't think I would use the word rearrangement. I would rather say maturity, our spiritual growth and maturation, can reach the point, as it does in the great saints, at which they are far more powerfully conscious of the ultimate than most of us are. So I think I want to say both those things.
We now have a question from... you've only got 15 minutes more to bear up with us, John, so we don't have much time to go. We now have Professor Schmidt-Leukel, and then the gentleman at the back, and then one more question there, and then we can carry on after that. Yes, Terry.
Thank you. It's not a question. It's more a comment. You know that I'm with you in almost all aspects of your work, but I think you made one mistake.
Only one.
At least one. A strategical mistake, perhaps. And that is using the Kantian analogy.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, I'm glad that Paul brought that up 5 minutes ago. The problem is, I think, you see, when we talk about divine ineffability or the transcategoriality of the real, so, mm-hmm. this can be understood in two different ways. It can be understood as a consequence from a Kantian epistemology. As Kant says, the thing in itself, everything in itself, is in a way ineffable because we don't have any knowledge of the thing in itself, but only we have only knowledge of how the thing appears to us.
Mm-hmm.
But divine ineffability or transcategoriality can also be understood in a metaphysical sense as deriving from the transcendent, infinite nature of ultimate reality.
Yeah.
And as I understood an interpretation of religion and a lot of your work, the second line was always the stronger argument, and you used Kant only as an analogy.
Yeah.
But the bulk of your critics, and also the criticism that you uttered yesterday, hinges on the first line. And the difference is, of course, that when you are criticized as a Kantian, people will argue, why in all the world should religions listen to Kant or to John Hick's interpretation of Kant? What do we have to do with this?
Yeah.
But when we remind the religious traditions that they themselves, in pre-modern times, all affirm that ultimate reality is beyond human concepts and human words, and we can show that this is empirically the case.
Yes. Huh?
Then they themselves need to get along with the question how to interpret then all the positive statements that they make about ultimate reality.
Yes, yeah.
So it is a problem of the religions themselves, nothing enforced upon them by some person called John Hick.
Yeah.
And therefore I think this is a big strategical mistake. So it would be better to get the Kantian analogy out and stay with the traditional teaching of the and there is a direct route leading to religious blood.
Well, I think once again I want to do both.
I have four hands up. One, the gentleman there, then I think Dr. Scrutton, and then you, sir, and then Gavin DaCosta, after which I will look at more hands if we have time. Yes, sir, to you.
Thanks. I recognize that you call your approach an hypothesis of religious pluralism, so you don't claim that it is the hypothesis of religious pluralism. I just wonder what responses you have to other pluralistic models, because David Ray Griffin suggests that there are two broad families of pluralisms,
yes.
The superficial pluralists, in which he includes yours because of the hastiness with which you seek out commonality between different traditions. In contrast, John Cole is a deep pluralist, being more attentive to the genuine otherness of each other. Just wonder what your responses are.
Yes, thank you. I don't want to use words like superficial and so on. But you're quite right, there are a number of pluralistic theories. One is, for example, Peter Byrne of London, in a very interesting book. I'm trying now to remember just exactly what he says. This may not be Byrne, it may be somebody else, but there are people who suggest that the different religions are aware of different aspects of the ultimate. And when you put them all together, you then get a full world theology. Now, I don't find that at all attractive, because the ultimate, being trans-categorial or ineffable, doesn't have aspects. The plurality is in the different ways in which we are conscious of it, but we're not conscious of different aspects of it. That would require it to have all the characteristics that are described in, as aspects. So I don't go for that one. And though I can't remember offhand all the other alternatives. Oh yes, another one is Markheim. Markheim. Now he suggests that the religions all have an authentic access to their own ultimate heaven, to use the Christian term. So there are many different, quote, heavens. But according to him, the best one, the superior heaven, is the Christian heaven. So what I point out to him is that he is much less kind, as it were, to non-Christians than either pluralists or inclusivists, because for the inclusivist, although all salvation is through Christ alone, yet everybody can end up in the Christian heaven, whereas for Markheim, only Christians end up in the Christian heaven, which is the best. Others end up in inferior realms. And this I find very odd and unacceptable.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have three hands up. I think at the time available to us, we can only take those three questions. So I ask Dr. Stratton to speak now. But maybe, John, the others in the inferior heaven don't know that they're an inferior heaven.
No. But that's no excuse.
Yes,
thank you. Thank you.
Can
you hear me?
Yes.
Can you hear me? Okay. Yes. Shall I stand up? Thank you very much. Actually, that follows on quite naturally from the previous question. You describe the meal as a single transcategorial reality. And I was wondering if you could clarify how you reconcile those two, single and transcategorial, and whether if the transcategorial is single, then ultimately you prefer monotheistic faith to polytheistic faiths in their conception of the divine.
Yes, if I've got this right, transcategorial simply means beyond all the categories of the human mind, or in an older language, ineffable. Going back to you, you said therefore what?
Single is a category.
Sorry?
Single is a category.
Oh, yes, right. Well, no, you can't apply, so it's transcategorial, you can't apply any categories, single or multiple or double or triple. You can't apply any of them, personal, impersonal, etc., etc., etc.
Dr. Stratton said, but you do, John.
Sorry?
But you do, she said.
In what
you
way?
You do apply the single to the ultimate.
Well, I don't. But you see, if in our human language we ask ourselves, is there one ultimate or many ultimates, the very word ultimate makes us say there's only one. Otherwise, if you had two, neither of them would be ultimate. So we have to say in our human language that the ultimate is one. even though we mean it in a very peculiar sense, it's not one as opposed to two.
And now you, thank you.
Professor John, the R began by quite rightly reminding your audience today of how you combine being an eminent scholar with the practical outworking of your Christian faith in terms of your work here with others, fighting against racism in this city. And it's salutary that no one has followed any question up in the last hour. And I just wanted to raise with you something about praxis and theological import. If I take my colleagues around this room to Leeds, I could take you to huge, white, working-class outer estates where the churches virtually have given up in terms of people attending, where the black African churches have moved in great numbers. On those estates, people are voting for the BNP in local and indeed in national elections. Mm. The church leaders in West Yorkshire, like your good selves here, are at the forefront of working against racism as ever.
Mm.
And that's a tribute to all the Christians and the churches working ecumenically and indeed multi-faith. The problem is that they have no real bearing upon the lives of most of those people on those outer estates.
Mm.
And the difficulty therefore is for my urban officer and my racial justice officer, they come to me and say, we cannot get anywhere on these estates. There is no way in which the church has any real presence as it would have done 20 or 30 years ago.
Yeah.
So that's a praxis problem for practitioners like parish clergy.
Mm.
The difficulty theologically, if we go to our Quaker friend or indeed the implications of what most of us would hold here, is those people who vote for the BNP are themselves subject to the usual poverty restrictions and everything else that's going on in our cities. They are created in the image of God. If we cannot have a presence with them because they've given up on church, how are we, both theologically and practically, to try to change hearts and minds in the context in which we find those people today?
Right, yes, well, that's a very good question, and I wish I knew the answer to it, but frankly, I don't. You're more likely to discover it in practice, but I don't know the answer.
We have now Professor Gavin Da Costa, and it does seem he's fairly brief. We can take one more question. Yes, Mr. Gillis. All right, Gavin.
Okay. John, when I run my unit at Bristol on the work of John Hick, lots of students really respond very excitedly when I'm teaching Death and Eternal Life, Evil and the God of Love. Lots of my Christian students are saying, yeah, this is helping us. Then we get to an interpretation of religion and they have a crisis because they argue, how can this man who is arguing universalism, etc., based on theism and a God of love, suddenly shift? So I say, no, John argues that this is utterly coherent and you need to read these early books as if you were a Christian, believing that it was true. And they say, but if it isn't, I don't like this anymore. So just ask for you to help me bring my students back on. The entire corpus with a sort of unity that is consistent.
Yes. Well, it would be quite something if the entire corpus was totally consistent. Because, you know, in the course of a long life, you develop and change your mind about some things. But certainly, Evil and the God of Love is written from an entirely intra-Christian point of view. I don't think it even mentions other religions. But it was only later than reading that, writing that, that the problem of other religions became central for me. Now, that's all I can say, really.
We must allow John to have a development of thought. Yes. Well, but first we ask Chester Gillis and then the student. Yeah. Okay, Chester, you're getting the mic. It's coming us. You, it's just behind you.
John, you just alluded to a long and rich life and transitions in your
writing, you've also made personal transitions in your even your religious identity within Christianity. And I don't know if you want to talk about that or if moving in your Christian identities from evangelical Christianity, Presbyterianism, and more recently I think Quakerism, how do those movements work in your own life vis-a-vis your theology?
You're asking how this fits together theologically. Well, I don't know what it does, because you see, when I was a student of law, before turning to philosophy, I had a very powerful evangelical conversion and took on board the entire, not merely traditional, but actually fundamentalist form of religion. And I think I was just totally wrong. So that there isn't a consistency throughout. Now I would regard myself as theologically an extremely liberal Christian, so liberal that some people would say this has gone to the point of heresy, and it may be that technically it has. So I would reckon from a Catholic point of view, it probably this is the case. But personally, I don't mind at all. I'm quite happy to be a heretic.
I think, is it true that there is a student who wanted to ask the question? That is positively the very last question to end this session. Please, ask your question.
We're going up in time now, especially people my age, where there's...
Sorry, could you speak up a bit?
Sorry, there's millions of people now in Britain, especially who are growing up, who are my kind of age, who have no close affiliation to a particular religion or a particular faith. I'm interested to know how you think they could or should partake in their religious life. Because of a lack of that affiliation with a particular religion, it doesn't mean that they're opposed to a religious life of any sort, but how do you think they could or should partake in one?
I don't think I heard all that, but you're asking if you're a young person who has no religious affiliation at all, what would I suggest that they do? Is that it?
Yeah.
Well, the very fact of raising the question suggests, doesn't it, that there is an interest in religion, but it's an unfulfilled interest. And personally, this is purely personally, I would not recommend them to go to the local Catholic or the local Methodist or the local United Reformed Church. I'd recommend them to go to the nearest Quaker meeting. Because, you see, the Quakers are not tied down to a creed. There's a great variety of beliefs amongst Quakers. And the practice of silence, you see, encourages the mystical side of us. And, as a purely practical answer, I would say try, at least, a Quaker meeting.
Well, thank you very much. I think we have to stop here. It's 12 o'clock now. And ladies and gentlemen, I'm sure you'll agree that we are privileged to be here in the company of John Hick. This has been an exhausting session. It's not easy to field questions for 1 hour, not knowing what those questions will be. And we are in awe of the wonderful way you have answered our questions, John. And we thank you very much indeed for being present here, for answering our questions so well and so graciously. And let us show our appreciation.